Finally, I was impressed with what an unalterable assurance I believed which two people were my parents, though this was impossible for me to know otherwise than by hearsay. By bringing all this into my consideration, thou didst persuade me that it was not the ones who believed thy books, which with so great authority thou hast established among nearly all nations, but those who did not believe them who were to be blamed. Moreover, those men were not to be listened to who would say to me, "How do you know that those scriptures were imparted to mankind by the Spirit of the one and most true God?" For this was the point that was most of all to be believed, since no wranglings of blasphemous questions, such as I had read in the books of the self-contradicting philosophers, could once snatch from me the belief that thou dost exist, although what thou art I did not know, and that to thee belongs the governance of human affairs. This much I believed, sometimes more strongly than other times, but I always believed both that thou art and that thou hast a care for us, although I was ignorant both as to what should be thought about thy substance and as to which way led or led back to thee. Thus, since we are too weak by unaided reason to find out truth, and since, because of this, we need the authority of the holy writings, I had now begun to believe that thou wouldst not, under any circumstances, have given such eminent authority to those scriptures throughout all lands, if it had not been that through them thy will may be believed in, and that thou mightest be sought. For as to those passages in the scripture which had heretofore appeared incongruous and offensive to me, now that I had heard several of them expounded reasonably, I could see that they were to be resolved by the mysteries of spiritual interpretation. The authority of scripture seemed to me all the more revered and worthy of devout belief because, although it was visible for all to read, it reserved the full majesty of its secret wisdom within its spiritual profundity. While it stooped to all in the great plainness of its language and simplicity of style, it yet required the closest attention of the most serious-minded, so that it might receive all into its common bosom, and direct some few through its narrow passages toward thee. Yet many more than would have been the case had there not been in it such a lofty authority, which nevertheless allured multitudes to its bosom by its holy humility. I continued to reflect upon these things, and thou wast with me. I sighed, and thou didst hear me. I vacillated, and thou guidedst me. I roamed the broad way of the world, and thou didst not desert me. Chapter 6. I was still eagerly aspiring to honours, money, and matrimony, and thou didst mock me. In pursuit of these ambitions I endured the most bitter hardships, in which thou wast being the more gracious, the less thou wouldst allow anything that was not thee to grow sweet to me. Look into my heart, O Lord, whose prompting it is that I should recall all this, and confess it to thee. Now let my soul cleave to thee, now that thou hast freed her from that fast-sticking glue of death. How wretched she was! And thou didst irritate her sore wound, so that she might forsake all else and turn to thee, who art above all, and without whom all things would be nothing at all, so that she should be converted and healed. How wretched I was at that time, and how thou didst deal with me so as to make me aware of my wretchedness, I recall from the incident of the day on which I was preparing to recite a panegyric on the emperor. In it I was to deliver many a lie, and the lying was to be applauded by those who knew I was lying. My heart was agitated with this sense of guilt, and it seethed with the fever of my uneasiness. For while walking along one of the streets of Milan, I saw a poor beggar, with what I believed was a full belly, joking and hilarious. And I sighed and spoke to the friends around me of the many sorrows that flowed from our madness, because in spite of all our exertions, such as those I was then labouring in, dragging the burden of my unhappiness under the spur of ambition, and by dragging it, increasing it at the same time, still and all we aimed only to attain that very happiness which this beggar had reached before us, and there was a grim chance that we should never attain it. For what he had obtained through a few coins got by his begging, I was still scheming for by many a wretched and tortuous turning, namely, the joy of a passing felicity. He had not, indeed, gained true joy, but at the same time, with all my ambitions, I was seeking one still more untrue. Anyhow, he was now joyous, and I was anxious. He was free from care, and I was full of alarms. Now, if anyone should inquire of me whether I should prefer to be merry or anxious, I would reply, merry. Again, if I had been asked whether I should prefer to be as he was, or as I myself then was, I would have chosen to be myself, though I was beset with cares and alarms. But would not this have been a false choice? Was the contrast valid? Actually, I ought not to prefer myself to him because I happened to be more learned than he was, for I got no great pleasure from my learning, but sought rather to please men by its exhibition, and this not to instruct, but only to please. Thus thou didst break my bones with the rod of thy correction. Let my soul take its leave of those who say, it makes a difference as to the object from which a man derives his joy. The beggar rejoiced in drunkenness, you longed to rejoice in glory. What glory, O Lord? The kind that is not in thee, for just as his was no true joy, so was mine no true glory. But it turned my head all the more. He would get over his drunkenness that same night, but I had slept with mine many a night, and risen again with it, and was to sleep again and rise again with it, I know not how many times. It does indeed make a difference as to the object from which a man's joy is gained. I know this is so, and I know that the joy of a faithful hope is incomparably beyond such vanity. Yet, at the same time, this beggar was beyond me, for he truly was the happier man, not only because he was thoroughly steeped in his mirth, while I was torn to pieces with my cares, but because he had gotten his wine by giving good wishes to the passers-by, while I was following after the ambition of my pride by lying. Much to this effect I said to my good companions, and I saw how readily they reacted pretty much as I did. Thus I found that it went ill with me, and I fretted and doubled that very ill. And if any prosperity smiled upon me, I loathed to seize it, for almost before I could grasp it, it would fly away. Chapter 7. Those of us who were living like friends together used to bemoan our lot in our common talk. But I discussed it with Alypius and Nebridius, more especially and in very familiar terms. Alypius had been born in the same town as I. His parents were of the highest rank there, but he was a bit younger than I. He had studied under me when I first taught in our town, and then afterward at Carthage. He esteemed me highly because I appeared to him good and learned, and I esteemed him for his inborn love of virtue, which was uncommonly marked in a man so young. But in the whirlpool of Carthaginian fashion, where frivolous spectacles are hotly followed, he had been inveigled into the madness of the gladiatorial games. While he was miserably tossed about in this fad, I was teaching rhetoric there in a public school. At that time he was not attending my classes because of some ill feeling that had arisen between me and his father. I then came to discover how fatally he doted upon the circus, and I was deeply grieved, for he seemed likely to cast away his very great promise, if, indeed, he had not already done so. Yet I had no means of advising him, or any way of reclaiming him through restraint, either by the kindness of a friend or by the authority of a teacher. For I imagined that his feelings toward me were the same as his father's. But this turned out not to be the case. Indeed, disregarding his father's will in the matter, he began to be friendly and to visit my lecture room, to listen for a while and then depart. But it slipped my memory to try to deal with his problem, to prevent him from ruining his excellent mind in his blind and headstrong passion for frivolous sport. But thou, O Lord, who holdest the helm of all that thou hast created, thou hadst not forgotten him who was one day to be numbered among thy sons, a chief minister of thy sacrament. And in order that his amendment might plainly be attributed to thee, thou broughtest it about through me while I knew nothing of it. One day, when I was sitting in my accustomed place with my scholars before me, he came in, greeted me, sat himself down, and fixed his attention on the subject I was then discussing. It so happened that I had a passage in hand, and while I was interpreting it, a simile occurred to me, taken from the gladiatorial games. It struck me as relevant to make more pleasant and plain the point I wanted to convey by adding a biting jibe at those whom that madness had enthralled. Thou knowest, O our God, that I had no thought at that time of curing Alypius of that plague, but he took it to himself and thought that I would not have said it but for his sake. And what any other man would have taken as an occasion of offence against me, this worthy young man took as a reason for being offended at himself, and for loving me the more fervently. Thou hast said it long ago, and written in thy book, "Rebuke a wise man, and he will love you." Now I had not rebuked him, but thou who canst make use of everything, both witting and unwitting, and in the order which thou thyself knowest to be best, and that order is right, thou madest my heart and tongue into burning coals, with which thou mightest cauterize and cure the hopeful mind thus languishing. Let him be silent in thy praise, who does not meditate on thy mercy, which rises up in my inmost parts to confess to thee. For after that speech, Alypius rushed up out of that deep pit into which he had wilfully plunged, and in which he had been blinded by its miserable pleasures, and he roused his mind with a resolve to moderation. When he had done this, all the filth of the gladiatorial pleasures dropped away from him, and he went to them no more. Then he also prevailed upon his reluctant father to let him be my pupil, and at the son's urging, the father at last consented. Thus Alypius began again to hear my lectures, and became involved with me in the same superstition, loving in the Manichaeans that outward display of ascetic discipline which he believed was true and unfeigned. It was, however, a senseless and seducing continence which ensnared precious souls who were not able as yet to reach the height of true virtue, and who were easily beguiled with a veneer of what was only a shadowy and feigned virtue. Chapter 8. He had gone on to Rome before me to study law, which was the worldly way which his parents were forever urging him to pursue, and there he was carried away again with an incredible passion for the gladiatorial shows. For, although he had been utterly opposed to such spectacles and detested them, one day he met by chance a company of his acquaintances and fellow students returning from dinner, and, with a friendly violence, they drew him, resisting and objecting vehemently, into the amphitheatre, on a day of those cruel and murderous shows. He protested to them, "Though you drag my body to that place and set me down there, you cannot force me to give my mind or lend my eyes to these shows. Thus I will be absent while present, and so overcome both you and them." When they heard this, they dragged him on in, probably interested to see whether he could do as he said. When they got to the arena, and had taken what seats they could get, the whole place became a tumult of inhuman frenzy. But Alypius kept his eyes closed, and forbade his mind to roam abroad after such wickedness. Would that he had shut his ears also, for when one of the combatants fell in the fight, a mighty cry from the whole audience stirred him so strongly that, overcome by curiosity, and still prepared, as he thought, to despise and rise superior to it, no matter what it was, he opened his eyes and was struck with a deeper wound in his soul than the victim whom he desired to see had been in his body. Thus he fell more miserably than the one whose fall had raised that mighty clamour, which had entered through his ears and unlocked his eyes to make way for the wounding and beating down of his soul, which was more audacious than truly valiant. Also it was weaker because it presumed on its own strength when it ought to have depended on thee. For as soon as he saw the blood, he drank in with it a savage temper, and he did not turn away, but fixed his eyes on the bloody pastime, unwittingly drinking in the madness, delighted with the wicked contest, and drunk with bloodlust. He was now no longer the same man who came in, but was one of the mob he came into, a true companion of those who had brought him thither. Why need I say more? He looked, he shouted, he was excited, and he took away with him the madness that would stimulate him to come again, not only with those who first enticed him, but even without them, indeed, dragging in others besides. And yet from all this, with a most powerful and most merciful hand, thou didst pluck him, and taught him not to rest his confidence in himself but in thee. But not till long after. Chapter 9. But this was all being stored up in his memory as medicine for the future. So also was that other incident, when he was still studying under me at Carthage, and was meditating at noonday in the marketplace on what he had to recite, as scholars usually have to do for practice, and thou didst allow him to be arrested by the police officers in the marketplace as a thief. I believe, O my God, that thou didst allow this for no other reason than that this man, who was in the future to prove so great, should now begin to learn that, in making just decisions, a man should not readily be condemned by other men with reckless credulity. For as he was walking up and down alone before the judgment seat with his tablets and pen, lo, a young man, another one of the scholars, who was the real thief, secretly brought a hatchet, and, without Alypius seeing him, got in as far as the leaden bars which protected the silversmith's shop, and began to hack away at the lead gratings. But when the noise of the hatchet was heard, the silversmiths below began to call to each other in whispers, and sent men to arrest whomsoever they should find. The thief heard their voices, and ran away, leaving his hatchet because he was afraid to be caught with it. Now Alypius, who had not seen him come in, got a glimpse of him as he went out, and noticed that he went off in great haste. Being curious to know the reasons, he went up to the place where he found the hatchet, and stood wondering and pondering, when, behold, those that were sent caught him alone, holding the hatchet which had made the noise which had startled them and brought them there. They seized him and dragged him away, gathering the tenants of the marketplace about them and boasting that they had caught a notorious thief. Thereupon he was led away to appear before the judge. But this is as far as his lesson was to go. For immediately, O Lord, thou didst come to the rescue of his innocence, of which thou wast the sole witness. As he was being led off to prison, or punishment, they were met by the master builder who had charge of the public buildings. The captors were especially glad to meet him, because he had more than once suspected them of stealing the goods that had been lost out of the marketplace. Now, at last, they thought they could convince him who it was that had committed the thefts. But the custodian had often met Alypius at the house of a certain senator, whose receptions he used to attend. He recognized him at once, and, taking his hand, led him apart from the throng, inquired the cause of all the trouble, and learned what had occurred. He then commanded all the rabble still around, and very uproarious and full of threatenings they were, to come along with him, and they came to the house of the young man who had committed the deed. There, before the door, was a slave boy so young that he was not restrained from telling the whole story by fear of harming his master. And he had followed his master to the marketplace. Alypius recognized him, and whispered to the architect, who showed the boy the hatchet and asked whose it was. "Ours," he answered directly. And being further questioned, he disclosed the whole affair. Thus the guilt was shifted to that household, and the rabble, who had begun to triumph over Alypius, were shamed. And so he went away home, this man who was to be the future steward of thy word and judge of so many causes in thy church, a wiser and more experienced man. Chapter 10. I found him at Rome, and he was bound to me with the strongest possible ties, and he went with me to Milan, in order that he might not be separated from me, and also that he might obtain some law practice, for which he had qualified with a view to pleasing his parents more than himself. He had already sat 3 times as assessor, showing an integrity that seemed strange to many others, though he thought them strange who could prefer gold to integrity. His character had also been tested, not only by the bait of covetousness, but by the spur of fear. At Rome he was assessor to the secretary of the Italian treasury. There was at that time a very powerful senator to whose favours many were indebted, and of whom many stood in fear. In his usual high-handed way, he demanded to have a favour granted him that was forbidden by the laws. This Alypius resisted. A bribe was promised, but he scorned it with all his heart. Threats were employed, but he trampled them underfoot, so that all men marvelled at so rare a spirit, which neither coveted the friendship nor feared the enmity of a man at once so powerful and so widely known for his great resources of helping his friends and doing harm to his enemies. Even the official whose counsellor Alypius was, although he was unwilling that the favour should be granted, would not openly refuse the request, but passed the responsibility on to Alypius, alleging that he would not permit him to give his assent. And the truth was that even if the judge had agreed, Alypius would have simply left the court. There was one matter, however, which appealed to his love of learning, in which he was very nearly led astray. He found out that he might have books copied for himself at Praetorian rates, that is, at public expense. But his sense of justice prevailed, and he changed his mind for the better, thinking that the rule that forbade him was still more profitable than the privilege that his office would have allowed him. These are little things, but he that is faithful in a little matter is faithful also in a great one. Nor can that possibly be void which was uttered by the mouth of thy truth. If, therefore, you have not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, who will commit to your trust the true riches? And if you have not been faithful in that which is another man's, who shall give you that which is your own? Such a man was Alypius, who clung to me at that time, and who wavered in his purpose, just as I did, as to what course of life to follow. Nebridius also had come to Milan for no other reason than that he might live with me in a most ardent search after truth and wisdom. He had left his native place near Carthage, and Carthage itself, where he usually lived, leaving behind his fine family estate, his house, and his mother, who would not follow him. Like me, he sighed. Like me, he wavered, an ardent seeker after the true life, and a most acute analyst of the most abstruse questions. So there were three begging mouths, sighing out their wants one to the other, and waiting upon thee that thou mightest give them their meat in due season. And in all the vexations with which thy mercy followed our worldly pursuits, we sought for the reason why we suffered so. And all was darkness. We turned away, groaning and exclaiming, "How long shall these things be?" And this we often asked, yet for all our asking we did not relinquish them, for as yet we had not discovered anything certain which, when we gave those others up, we might grasp in their stead. Chapter 11. And I especially puzzled and wondered when I remembered how long a time had passed since my 19th year, in which I had first fallen in love with wisdom, and had determined as soon as I could find her to abandon the empty hopes and mad delusions of vain desires. Behold, I was now getting close to 30, still stuck fast in the same mire, still greedy of enjoying present goods which fly away and distract me. And I was still saying, "Tomorrow I shall discover it. Behold, it will become plain, and I shall see it. Behold, Faustus will come and explain everything." Or I would say, "Oh, you mighty academics, is there no certainty that man can grasp for the guidance of his life? No, let us search the more diligently, and let us not despair. See, the things in the church's books that appeared so absurd to us before do not appear so now, and may be otherwise and honestly interpreted. I will set my feet upon that step where, as a child, my parents placed me, until the clear truth is discovered. But where and when shall it be sought? Ambrose has no leisure, we have no leisure to read. Where are we to find the books? How or where could I get hold of them? From whom could I borrow them? Let me set a schedule for my days, and set apart certain hours for the health of the soul. A great hope has risen up in us, because the Catholic faith does not teach what we thought it did, and vainly accused it of. Its teachers hold it as an abomination to believe that God is limited by the form of a human body. And do I doubt that I should knock in order for the rest also to be opened unto me? My pupils take up the morning hours. What am I doing with the rest of the day? Why not do this? But then, when am I to visit my influential friends whose favours I need? When am I to prepare the orations that I sell to the class? When would I get some recreation and relax my mind from the strain of work? Perish everything, and let us dismiss these idle triflings. Let me devote myself solely to the search for truth. This life is unhappy, death uncertain. If it comes upon me suddenly, in what state shall I go hence, and where shall I learn what here I have neglected? Should I not indeed suffer the punishment of my negligence here? But suppose death cuts off and finishes all care and feeling? This too is a question that calls for inquiry. God forbid that it should be so. It is not without reason, it is not in vain, that the stately authority of the Christian faith has spread over the entire world, and God would never have done such great things for us if the life of the soul perished with the death of the body. Why, therefore, do I delay in abandoning my hopes of this world and giving myself wholly to seek after God and the blessed life? But wait a moment. This life also is pleasant, and it has a sweetness of its own, not at all negligible. We must not abandon it lightly, for it would be shameful to lapse back into it again. See now, it is important to gain some post of honour, and what more should I desire? I have crowds of influential friends, if nothing else, and if I push my claims, a governorship may be offered me, and a wife with some money, so that she would not be an added expense. This would be the height of my desire. Many men who are great and worthy of imitation have combined the pursuit of wisdom with a marriage life. While I talked about these things, and the winds of opinions veered about and tossed my heart hither and thither, time was slipping away. I delayed my conversion to the Lord. I postponed from day to day the life in Thee, but I could not postpone the daily death in myself. I was enamoured of a happy life, but I still feared to seek it in its own abode, and so I fled from it while I sought it. I thought I should be miserable if I were deprived of the embraces of a woman, and I never gave a thought to the medicine that Thy mercy has provided for the healing of that infirmity, for I had never tried it. As for continence, I imagined that it depended on one's own strength, though I found no such strength in myself, for in my folly I knew not what is written. None can be continent unless thou dost grant it. Certainly thou wouldst have given it, if I had beseeched thy ears with heartfelt groaning, and if I had cast my care upon thee with firm faith. Chapter 12. Actually, it was Alypius who prevented me from marrying, urging that if I did so it would not be possible for us to live together and to have as much undistracted leisure in the love of wisdom as we had long desired. For he himself was so chaste that it was wonderful, all the more because in his early youth he had entered upon the path of promiscuity, but had not continued in it. Instead, feeling sorrow and disgust at it, he had lived from that time down to the present most continently. I quoted against him the examples of men who had been married and still lovers of wisdom, who had pleased God and had been loyal and affectionate to their friends. I fell far short of them in greatness of soul, and, enthralled with the disease of my carnality and its deadly sweetness, I dragged my chain along, fearing to be loosed of it. Thus I rejected the words of him who counselled me wisely, as if the hand that would have loosed the chain only hurt my wound. Moreover, the serpent spoke to Alypius himself by me, weaving and lying in his path, by my tongue to catch him with pleasant snares in which his honourable and free feet might be entangled. For he wondered that I, for whom he had such a great esteem, should be stuck so fast in the glue-pot of pleasure as to maintain, whenever we discussed the subject, that I could not possibly live a celibate life. And when I urged in my defence against his accusing questions that the hasty and stolen delight which he had tasted and now hardly remembered, and therefore too easily disparaged, was not to be compared with a settled acquaintance with it, and that if to this stable acquaintance were added the honourable name of marriage, he would not then be astonished at my inability to give it up, when I spoke thus, then he also began to wish to be married, not because he was overcome by the lust for such pleasures, but out of curiosity. For, he said, he longed to know what that could be without which my life, which he thought was so happy, seemed to me to be no life at all, but a punishment. For he who wore no chain was amazed at my slavery, and his amazement awoke the desire for experience, and from that he would have gone on to the experiment itself, and then perhaps he would have fallen into the very slavery that amazed him in me, since he was ready to enter into a covenant with death. For he that loves danger shall fall into it. Now, the question of conjugal honour in the ordering of a good married life and the bringing up of children interested us but slightly. What afflicted me most, and what had made me already a slave to it, was the habit of satisfying an insatiable lust. But Alypius was about to be enslaved by a merely curious wonder. This is the state we were in, until thou, O Most High, who never forsakest our lowliness, didst take pity on our misery, and didst come to our rescue in wonderful and secret ways. Chapter 13. Active efforts were made to get me a wife. I wooed, I was engaged, and my mother took the greatest pains in the matter, for her hope was that, when I was once married, I might be washed clean in health-giving baptism for which I was being daily prepared, as she joyfully saw, taking note that her desires and promises were being fulfilled in my faith. Yet when, at my request and her own impulse, she called upon thee daily with strong, heartfelt cries, that thou wouldst by a vision disclose unto her a leading about my future marriage, thou wouldst not. She did indeed see certain vain and fantastic things, such as are conjured up by the strong preoccupation of the human spirit, and these, she supposed, had some reference to me, and she told me about them, but not with the confidence she usually had when thou hadst shown her anything. For she always said that she could distinguish, by a certain feeling impossible to describe, between thy revelations and the dreams of her own soul. Yet the matter was pressed forward, and the proposals were made for a girl who was as yet some 2 years too young to marry. And because she pleased me, I agreed to wait for her. Chapter 14. Many in my band of friends, consulting about and abhorring the turbulent vexations of human life, had often considered and were now almost determined to undertake a peaceful life, away from the turmoil of men. This, we thought, could be obtained by bringing together what we severally owned, and thus making of it a common household, so that in the sincerity of our friendship nothing should belong more to one than to the other, but all were to have one purse, and the whole was to belong to each and to all. We thought that this group might consist of 10 persons, some of whom were very rich, especially Romanianus, my fellow townsman, an intimate friend from childhood days. He had been brought up to the court on grave business matters, and he was the most earnest of us all about the project, and his voice was of great weight in commending it, because his estate was far more ample than that of the others. We had resolved also that each year 2 of us should be managers, and provide all that was needful, while the rest were left undisturbed. But when we began to reflect whether this would be permitted by our wives, which some of us had already and others hoped to have, the whole plan, so excellently framed, collapsed in our hands and was utterly wrecked and cast aside. From this we fell again into sighs and groans, and our steps followed the broad and beaten ways of the world. For many thoughts were in our hearts, but thy counsel standeth fast for ever. In thy counsel thou didst mock ours, and didst prepare thy own plan, for it was thy purpose to give us meat in due season, to open thy hand, and to fill our souls with blessing. Chapter 15. Meanwhile my sins were being multiplied. My mistress was torn from my side as an impediment to my marriage, and my heart, which clung to her, was torn and wounded till it bled. And she went back to Africa, vowing to thee never to know any other man, and leaving with me my natural son by her. But I, unhappy as I was, and weaker than a woman, could not bear the delay of the 2 years that should elapse before I could obtain the bride I sought. And so, since I was not a lover of wedlock so much as a slave of lust, I procured another mistress, not a wife, of course. Thus, in bondage to a lasting habit, the disease of my soul might be nursed up and kept in its vigour, or even increased until it reached the realm of matrimony. Nor indeed was the wound healed that had been caused by cutting away my former mistress, only it ceased to burn and throb, and began to fester, and was more dangerous because it was less painful. Chapter 16. Thine be the praise, unto thee be the glory, O fountain of mercies. I became more wretched, and thou didst come nearer. Thy right hand was ever ready to pluck me out of the mire and to cleanse me, but I did not know it. Nor did anything call me back from a still deeper plunge into carnal pleasure, except the fear of death and of thy future judgment, which, amid all the waverings of my opinions, never faded from my breast. And I discussed with my friends Olypius and Nebridius the nature of good and evil, maintaining that, in my opinion, Epicurus would have carried off the palm if I had not believed what Epicurus would not believe, that after death there remains a life for the soul and places of recompense. And I demanded of them, suppose we are immortal and live in the enjoyment of perpetual bodily pleasure, and that without any fear of losing it. Why, then, should we not be happy, or why should we search for anything else? I did not know that this was in fact the root of my misery, that I was so fallen and blinded that I could not discern the light of virtue and of beauty, which must be embraced for its own sake, which the eye of flesh cannot see, and only the inner vision can see. Nor did I, alas, consider the reason why I found delight in discussing these very perplexities, shameful as they were, with my friends. For I could not be happy without friends, even according to the notions of happiness I had then, and no matter how rich the store of my carnal pleasures might be. Yet of a truth I loved my friends for their own sakes, and felt that they in turn loved me for my own sake. O crooked ways! Woe to the audacious soul which hoped that by forsaking thee it would find some better thing! It tossed and turned upon back and side and belly, but the bed is hard, and thou alone givest it rest. And lo, thou art near, and thou deliverest us from our wretched wanderings, and establishest us in thy way. And thou comfortest us, and sayest, Run, I will carry you. Yea, I will lead you home, and then I will set you free. Book 7. The Conversion to Neoplatonism. Augustine traces his growing disenchantment with the Manichaean conceptions of God and evil, and the dawning understanding of God's incorruptibility. But his thought is still bound by his materialistic notions of reality. He rejects astrology and turns to the study of Neoplatonism. There follows an analysis of the differences between Platonism and Christianity, and a remarkable account of his appropriation of Plotinian wisdom and his experience of a Plotinian ecstasy. From this he comes finally to the diligent study of the Bible, especially the writings of the Apostle Paul. His pilgrimage is drawing toward its goal, and he begins to know Jesus Christ and to be drawn to him in hesitant faith. Chapter 1. Dead now was that evil and shameful youth of mine, and I was passing into full manhood. As I increased in years, the worse was my vanity, for I could not conceive of any substance but the sort I could see with my own eyes. I no longer thought of thee, O God, by the analogy of a human body. Ever since I inclined my ear to philosophy, I had avoided this error. And the truth on this point I rejoiced to find in the faith of our spiritual mother, thy Catholic Church. Yet I could not see how else to conceive thee. And I, a man, and such a man, sought to conceive thee, the sovereign and only true God. In my inmost heart I believed that thou art incorruptible, and inviolable, and unchangeable, because, though I knew not how or why, I could still see plainly and without doubt that the corruptible is inferior to the incorruptible, the inviolable obviously superior to its opposite, and the unchangeable better than the changeable. My heart cried out violently against all phantasms, and with this one clear certainty I endeavoured to brush away the swarm of unclean flies that swarmed around the eyes of my mind. But behold, they were scarcely scattered before they gathered again, buzzed against my face, and beclouded my vision. I no longer thought of God in the analogy of a human body, yet I was constrained to conceive thee to be some kind of body in space, either infused into the world or infinitely diffused beyond the world. And this was the incorruptible, inviolable, unchangeable substance which I thought was better than the corruptible, the violable, and the changeable. for whatever I conceived to be deprived of the dimensions of space appeared to me to be nothing, absolutely nothing, not even a void. For if a body is taken out of space, or if space is emptied of all its contents, of earth, water, air, or heaven, yet it remains an empty space, a spacious nothing, as it were. Being thus gross-hearted and not clear even to myself, I then held that whatever had neither length nor breadth, nor density nor solidity, and did not or could not receive such dimensions, was absolutely nothing. For at that time my mind dwelt only with ideas, which resembled the forms with which my eyes are still familiar. Nor could I see that the act of thought by which I formed those ideas was itself immaterial, and yet it could not have formed them if it were not itself a measurable entity. So also I thought about thee, O life of my life, as stretched out through infinite space, interpenetrating the whole mass of the world, reaching out beyond in all directions, to immensity without end, so that the earth should have thee, the heaven have thee, all things have thee, and all of them be limited in thee, while thou art placed nowhere at all. As the body of the air above the earth does not bar the passage of the light of the sun, so that the light penetrates it, not by bursting nor dividing, but filling it entirely, so I imagined that the body of heaven and air and sea, and even of the earth, was all open to thee, and, in all its greatest parts, as well as the smallest, was ready to receive thy presence by a secret inspiration, which, from within or without all, orders all things thou hast created. This was my conjecture, because I was unable to think of anything else. Yet it was untrue. For in this way a greater part of the earth would contain a greater part of thee, a smaller part, a smaller fraction of thee. All things would be full of thee in such a sense that there would be more of thee in an elephant than in a sparrow, because one is larger than the other and fills a larger space. And this would make the portions of thyself present in the several portions of the world in fragments, great to the great, small to the small. But thou art not such a one. But as yet thou hadst not enlightened my darkness. Chapter 2. But it was not sufficient for me, O Lord, to be able to oppose those deceived deceivers, and those dumb orators, dumb because thy word did not sound forth from them, to oppose them with the answer which, in the old Carthaginian days, Nebridius used to propound, shaking all of us who heard it. What could this imaginary people of darkness, which the Manichaeans usually set up as an army opposed to thee, have done to thee if thou hadst declined the combat? If they replied that it could have hurt thee, they would then have made thee violable and corruptible. If, on the other hand, the dark could have done thee no harm, then there was no cause for any battle at all. There was less cause for a battle in which a part of thee, one of thy members, a child of thy own substance, should be mixed up with opposing powers, not of thy creation, and should be corrupted and deteriorated and changed by them from happiness into misery, so that it could not be delivered and cleansed without thy help. This offspring of thy substance was supposed to be the human soul to which thy word, free, pure, and entire, could bring help when it was being enslaved, contaminated, and corrupted. But on their hypothesis, that word was itself corruptible, because it is one and the same substance as the soul. And therefore, if they admitted that thy nature, whatsoever thou art, is incorruptible, then all these assertions of theirs are false, and should be rejected with horror. But if thy substance is corruptible, then this is self-evidently false, and should be abhorred at first utterance. This line of argument, then, was enough against those deceivers who ought to be cast forth from a surfeited stomach, for out of this dilemma they could find no way of escape, without dreadful sacrilege of mind and tongue, when they think and speak such things about thee. Chapter 3. But as yet, although I said and was firmly persuaded that thou, our Lord, the true God, who madest not only our souls but our bodies as well, and not only our souls and bodies but all creatures and all things, wast free from stain and alteration, and in no way mutable, Yet I could not readily and clearly understand what was the cause of evil. Whatever it was, I realized that the question must be so analyzed as not to constrain me by any answer to believe that the immutable God was mutable, lest I should myself become the thing that I was seeking out. And so I pursued the search with a quiet mind, now in a confident feeling that what had been said by the Manichaeans, and I shrank from them with my whole heart, could not be true. I now realized that when they asked what was the origin of evil, their answer was dictated by a wicked pride, which would rather affirm that thy nature is capable of suffering evil than that their own nature is capable of doing it. And I directed my attention to understand what I now was told, that free will is the cause of our doing evil, and that thy just judgment is the cause of our having to suffer from its consequences. But I could not see this clearly. So then, trying to draw the eye of my mind up out of that pit, I was plunged back into it again, and trying often was just as often plunged back down. But one thing lifted me up toward thy light, and it was that I had come to know that I had a will, as certainly as I knew that I had life. When, therefore, I willed or was unwilling to do something, I was utterly certain that it was none but myself who willed or was unwilling. And immediately I realized that there was the cause of my sin. I could see that what I did against my will I suffered rather than did, and I did not regard such actions as faults, but rather as punishments in which I might quickly confess that I was not unjustly punished, since I believed thee to be most just. Who was it that put this in me, and implanted in me the root of bitterness, in spite of the fact that I was altogether the handiwork of my most sweet God? If the devil is to blame, who made the devil himself? And if he was a good angel who by his own wicked will became the devil, how did there happen to be in him that wicked will by which he became a devil, since a good creator made him wholly a good angel? By these reflections was I again cast down and stultified. Yet I was not plunged into that hell of error where no man confesses to thee, where I thought that thou didst suffer evil rather than that men do it. Chapter 4. For in my struggle to solve the rest of my difficulties, I now assumed henceforth as settled truth that the incorruptible must be superior to the corruptible, and I did acknowledge that thou, whatever thou art incorruptible. For there never yet was, nor will be, a soul able to conceive of anything better than thee, who art the highest and best good. And since most truly and certainly the incorruptible is to be placed above the corruptible, as I now admit it, it followed that I could rise in my thoughts to something better than my God, if thou wert not incorruptible. When, therefore, I saw that the incorruptible was to be preferred to the corruptible, I saw then where I ought to seek thee, and where I should look for the source of evil, that is, the corruption by which thy substance can in no way be profaned. For it is obvious that corruption in no way injures our God, by no inclination, by no necessity, by no unforeseen chance, because he is our God, and what he wills is good, and he himself is that good. But to be corrupted is not good. Nor art thou compelled to do anything against thy will, since thy will is not greater than thy power. But it would have to be greater if thou thyself wert greater than thyself. For the will and power of God are God himself. And what can take thee by surprise, since thou knowest all, and there is no sort of nature but thou knowest it? And what more should we say about why that substance which God is cannot be corrupted? Because if this were so, it could not be God. Chapter 5. And I kept seeking for an answer to the question, Whence is evil? And I sought it in an evil way, and I did not see the evil in my very search. I marshalled before the sight of my spirit all creation, all that we see of earth and sea and air and stars and trees and animals, and all that we do not see, the firmament of the sky above, and all the angels and all spiritual things. For my imagination arranged these also, as if they were bodies, in this place or that. And I pictured to myself thy creation as one vast mass, composed of various kinds of bodies, some of which were actually bodies, some of those which I imagined spirits were like. I pictured this mass as vast, of course not in its full dimensions, for these I could not know, but as large as I could possibly think, still only finite on every side. But thou, O Lord, I imagined as environing the mass on every side, and penetrating it, still infinite in every direction, as if there were a sea everywhere, and everywhere, through measureless space, nothing but an infinite sea. And it contained within itself some sort of sponge, huge but still finite, so that the sponge would in all its parts be filled from the immeasurable sea. Thus I conceived thy creation itself to be finite, and filled by thee the infinite. And I said, Behold God, and behold what God hath created. God is good, yea, most mightily and incomparably better than all his works. But yet he who is good has created them good. Behold how he encircles and fills them. Where, then, is evil? And whence does it come, and how has it crept in? What is its root, and what its seed? Has it no being at all? Why, then, do we fear and shun what has no being? Or if we fear it, needlessly, then surely that fear is evil by which the heart is unnecessarily stabbed and tortured, and indeed a greater evil, since we have nothing real to fear, and yet do fear. Therefore, either that is evil which we fear, or the act of fearing is itself evil. But then, whence does it come? Since God, who is good, has made all these things good. Indeed, he is the greatest and chiefest good, and hath created these lesser goods. But both creator and created are all good. Whence, then, is evil? Or again, was there some evil matter out of which he made and formed and ordered it, but left something in his creation that he did not convert into good? But why should this be? Was he powerless to change the whole lump, so that no evil would remain in it if he is the omnipotent? Finally, why would he make anything at all out of such stuff? Why did he not rather annihilate it by his same almighty power? Could evil exist contrary to his will? And if it were from eternity, why did he permit it to be non-existent for unmeasured intervals of time in the past? And why, then, was he pleased to make something out of it after so long a time? Or, if he wished now all of a sudden to create something, would not an almighty being have chosen to annihilate this evil matter and live by himself, the perfect, true, sovereign, and infinite good? Or, if it were not good that he who was good should not also be the framer and creator of what was good, then why was that evil matter not removed and brought to nothing, so that he might form good matter, out of which he might then create all things? For he would not be omnipotent if he were not able to create something good without being assisted by that matter which had not been created by himself. Such perplexities I revolved in my wretched breast, overwhelmed with gnawing cares, lest I die before I discovered the truth. And still the faith of thy Christ, our Lord and Saviour, as it was taught me by the Catholic Church, stuck fast in my heart. As yet it was unformed on many points, and diverged from rule of right doctrine, but my mind did not utterly lose it, and every day drank in more and more of it. Chapter 6. By now I had also repudiated the lying divinations and impious absurdities of the astrologers. Let thy mercies out of the depth of my soul confess this to thee also, O my God. For thou only, for who else is it who calls us back from the death of all errors, except the life which does not know how to die, and the wisdom which gives light to minds that need it, although it itself has no need of light, by which the whole universe is governed even to the fluttering leaves of the tree. Thou alone providedst also for my obstinacy with which I struggled against Vindicianus, a sagacious old man, and Nebridius, that remarkably talented young man. The former declared vehemently, and the latter frequently, though with some reservation, that no art existed by which we foresee future things. But men's surmises have oftentimes the help of chance, and out of many things which they foretold, some came to pass unawares to the predictors, who lighted on the truth by making so many guesses. And thou also providedst a friend for me, who was not a negligent consulter of the astrologers, even though he was not thoroughly skilled in the art either, as I said, one who consulted them out of curiosity. He knew a good deal about it, which, he said, he had heard from his father, and he never realized how far his ideas would help to overthrow my estimation of that art. His name was Firminus, and he had received a liberal education and was a cultivated rhetorician. It so happened that he consulted me, as one very dear to him, as to what I thought about some affairs of his in which his worldly hopes had risen, viewed in the light of his so-called horoscope. Although I had now begun to lean in this matter toward Nebridius's opinion, I did not quite decline to speculate about the matter or to tell him what thoughts still came into my irresolute mind, although I did add that I was almost persuaded now that these were but empty and ridiculous follies. He then told me that his father had been very much interested in such books, and that he had a friend who was as much interested in them as he was himself. They, in combined study and consultation, fanned the flame of their affection for this folly, going so far as to observe the moment when the dumb animals which belonged to their household gave birth to young, and then observed the position of the heavens with regard to them, so as to gather fresh evidence for this so-called art. Moreover, he reported that his father had told me that, at the same time his mother was about to give birth to him, Firminus, a female slave of a friend of his father's was also pregnant. This could not be hidden from her master, who kept records with the most diligent exactness of the birth dates even of his dogs. And so it happened to pass that, under the most careful observations, one for his wife and the other for his servant, with exact calculations of the days, hours, and minutes, both women were delivered at the same moment, so that both were compelled to cast the self-same horoscope down to the minute, the one for his son, the other for his young slave. For as soon as the women began to be in labour, they each sent word to the other as to what was happening in their respective houses, and had messengers ready to dispatch to one another as soon as they had information of the actual birth, and each, of course, knew instantly the exact time. It turned out, Firminus said, that the messengers from the respective houses met one another at a point equidistant from either house, so that neither of them could discern any difference either in the position of the stars or any other of the most minute points. And yet Firminus, born in a high estate in his parents' house, ran his course through the prosperous paths of this world, was increased in wealth and elevated to honours. At the same time the slave, the yoke of his condition being still unrelaxed, continued to serve his masters, as Firminus, who knew him, was able to report. Upon hearing and believing these things related by so reliable a person, all my resistance melted away. First, I endeavoured to reclaim Firminus himself from his superstition by telling him that after inspecting his horoscope, I ought, if I could foretell truly, to have seen in it parents eminent among their neighbours, a noble family in its own city, a good birth, a proper education, and liberal learning. But if that servant had consulted me with the same horoscope, since he had the same one, I ought again to tell him likewise truly that I saw in it the lowliness of his origin, the abjectness of his condition, and everything else different and contrary to the former prediction. If, then, by casting up the same horoscopes, I should, in order to speak the truth, make contrary analyses, or else speak falsely if I made identical readings, then surely it followed that whatever was truly foretold by the analysis of the horoscopes was not by art, but by chance. And whatever was said falsely was not from incompetence in the art, but from the error of chance. An opening being thus made in my darkness, I began to consider other implications involved here. Suppose that one of the fools, who followed such an occupation, and whom I longed to assail and to reduce to confusion, should urge against me that Firminus had given me false information, or that his father had informed him falsely. I then turned my thoughts to those that are born twins, who generally come out of the womb so near the one to the other that the short interval between them, whatever importance they may ascribe to it in the nature of things, cannot be noted by human observation or expressed in those tables which the astrologer uses to examine when he undertakes to pronounce the truth. But such pronouncements cannot be true, for looking into the same horoscopes, he must have foretold the same future for Esau and Jacob, whereas the same future did not turn out for them. He must therefore speak falsely. If he is to speak truly, then he must read contrary predictions into the same horoscopes. But this would mean that it was not by art, but by chance, that he would speak truly. For thou, O Lord, most righteous ruler of the universe, dost work by a secret impulse, whether those who inquired or those inquired of know it or not, so that the inquirer may hear what, according to the secret merit of his soul, he ought to hear from the deeps of thy righteous judgment. Therefore let no man say to thee, What is this? Or, Why is that? Let him not speak thus, for he is only a man. Chapter 7. By now, O my helper, thou hadst freed me from those fetters. But still I inquired, Whence is evil? And found no answer. But thou didst not allow me to be carried away from the faith by these fluctuations of thought. I still believed both that thou dost exist, and that thy substance is immutable, and that thou dost care for and wilt judge all men, and that in Christ thy Son our Lord, and the Holy Scriptures, which the authority of thy Catholic Church pressed on me, thou hast planned the way of man's salvation to that life which is to come after this death. With these convictions safe and immovably settled in my mind, I eagerly inquired, Whence is evil? What torments did my travailing heart then endure? What sighs, O my God! Yet even then thy ears were open, and I knew it not. And when in stillness I sought earnestly, those silent contritions of my soul were loud cries to thy mercy. No man knew, but thou knewest what I endured. How little of it could I express in words to the ears of my dearest friends? How could the whole tumult of my soul, for which neither time nor speech was sufficient, come to them? Yet the whole of it went into thy ears, all of which I bellowed out in the anguish of my heart. My desire was before thee, and the light of my eyes was not with me, for it was within and I was without. Nor was that light in any place, but I still kept thinking only of things that are contained in a place, and could find among them no place to rest in. They did not receive me in such a way that I could say, It is sufficient, it is well, nor did they allow me to turn back to where it might be well enough with me, for I was higher than they, though lower than thou. Thou art my true joy if I depend upon thee, and thou hadst subjected to me what thou didst create lower than I. And this was the true mean and middle way of salvation for me, to continue in thy image, and by serving thee have dominion over the body. But when I lifted myself proudly against thee, and ran against the Lord, even against his neck, with the thick bosses of my buckler, even the lower things were placed above me and pressed down on me, so that there was no respite or breathing space. They thrust on my sight on every side, in crowds and masses, and when I tried to think, the images of bodies obtruded themselves into my way back to thee, as if they would say to me, Where are you going, unworthy and unclean one? And all these had sprung out of my wound, for thou hadst humbled the haughty as one that is wounded. By my swelling pride I was separated from thee, and my bloated cheeks blinded my eyes. Chapter 8. But thou, O Lord, art for ever the same, yet thou art not for ever angry with us, for thou hast compassion on our dust and ashes. It was pleasing in thy sight to reform my deformity, and by inward stings thou didst disturb me, so that I was impatient until thou wert made clear to my inward sight. By the secret hand of thy healing my swelling was lessened. The disordered and darkened eyesight of my mind was from day to day made whole by the stinging salve of wholesome grief. Chapter 9. And first of all, willing to show me how thou dost resist the proud, but give grace to the humble, and how mercifully thou hast made known to men the way of humility, in that thy word was made flesh and dwelt among men, thou didst procure for me, through one inflated with the most monstrous pride, certain books of the Platonists, translated from Greek into Latin. And therein I found, not indeed in the same words, but to the self-same effect, enforced by many and various reasons, that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. All things were made by him, and without him was not anything made that was made. That which was made by him is life, and the life was the light of men, and the light shined in darkness, and the darkness comprehended it not. Furthermore, I read that the soul of man, though it bears witness to the light, yet itself is not the light, but the Word of God, being God, is that true light that lights every man who comes into the world. And further, that he was in the world, and the world was made by him, and the world knew him not. But that he came unto his own, and his own received him not. And as many as received him, to them gave he power to become the sons of God, even to them that believed on his name. This I did not find there. Similarly, I read there that God the Word was born not of flesh, nor of blood, nor of the will of man, nor the will of the flesh, but of God. But that the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, I found this nowhere there. And I discovered in those books, expressed in many and various ways, that the Son was in the form of God, and thought it not robbery to be equal in God, for he was naturally of the same substance, but that he emptied himself, and took upon himself the form of a servant, and was made in the likeness of men, and being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself, and became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. Wherefore God also hath highly exalted him from the dead, and given him a name above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow, of things in heaven, and things in earth, and things under the earth, and that every tongue should confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. This those books have not. I read further in them that before all times and beyond all times thy only Son remaineth unchangeably coeternal with thee, and that of his fulness all souls receive that they may be blessed, and that by participation in that wisdom which abides in them they are renewed, that they may be wise. But that in due time Christ died for the ungodly, and that thou sparedst not thy only Son, but deliveredst him up for us all, this is not there. For thou hast hid these things from the wise and prudent, and hast revealed them unto babes, that they that labour and are heavy laden might come unto him, and he might refresh them, because he is meek and lowly in heart. The meek will he guide in judgment, and the meek will he teach his way, beholding our lowliness and our trouble, and forgiving all our sins. But those who strut in the high boots of what they deem to be superior knowledge will not hear him who says, "Learn of me, for I am meek and lowly in heart, and you shall find rest for your souls." Thus, though they know God, yet they do not glorify him as God, nor are they thankful. Therefore they become vain in their imaginations, their foolish heart is darkened, and professing themselves to be wise, they become fools. And, moreover, I also read there how they changed the glory of their incorruptible nature into idols and various images, into an image made like corruptible man, and to birds and four-footed beasts and creeping things, namely, into that Egyptian food for which Esau lost his birthright, so that thy first-born people worshipped the head of a four-footed beast instead of thee, turning back in their hearts toward Egypt, and prostrating thy image, their own soul, before the image of an ox that eats grass. These things I found there, but I fed not on them. For it pleased thee, O Lord, to take away the reproach of his minority from Jacob, that the elder should serve the younger, and thou mightest call the Gentiles. And I had sought strenuously after that gold which thou didst allow thy people to take from Egypt, since wherever it was thine. And thou saidst unto the Athenians by the mouth of thy apostle that in thee we live and move and have our being, as one of their own poets had said. And truly these books came from there. But I did not set my mind on the idols of Egypt which they fashioned of gold, changing the truth of God into a lie, and worshipping and serving the creature more than the Creator. Chapter 10. And being admonished by these books to return into myself, I entered into my inward soul, guided by thee. This I could do because thou wast my helper. And I entered, and with the eye of my soul, such as it was, saw above the same eye of my soul and above my mind the immutable light. It was not the common light which all flesh can see, nor was it simply a greater one of the same sort, as if the light of day were to grow brighter and brighter and flood all space. It was not like that light, but different, yea, very different from all earthly light whatever. Nor was it above my mind in the same way as oil is above water, or heaven above earth. But it was higher, because it made me, and I was below it, because I was made by it. He who knows the truth knows that light, and he who knows it knows eternity. Love knows it, O eternal truth, and true love and beloved eternity. Thou art my God, to whom I sigh both night and day. When I first knew thee, thou didst lift me up, that I might see that there was something to be seen, though I was not yet fit to see it. And thou didst beat back the weakness of my sight, shining forth upon me thy dazzling beams of light, and I trembled with love and fear. I realized that I was far away from thee in the land of unlikeness, as if I heard thy voice from on high. I am the food of strong men. Grow, and you shall feed on me. Nor shall you change me, like the food of your flesh, into yourself, but you shall be changed into my likeness. And I understood that thou chastenest man for his iniquity, and makest my soul to be eaten away as though by a spider. And I said, Is truth therefore nothing, because it is not diffused through space, neither finite nor infinite? And thou didst cry to me from afar, I am that I am. And I heard this, as things are heard in the heart, and there was no room for doubt. I should have more readily doubted that I am alive than that the truth exists, the truth which is clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made. Chapter 11. And I viewed all the other things that are beneath thee, and I realized that they are neither wholly real, nor wholly unreal. They are real in so far as they come from thee, but they are unreal in so far as they are not what thou art. For that is truly real which remains immutable. It is good then for me to hold fast to God, for if I do not remain in him, neither shall I abide in myself. But he, remaining in himself, renews all things. And thou art the Lord my God, since thou standest in no need of my goodness. Chapter 12. And it was made clear to me that all things are good, even if they are corrupted. They could not be corrupted if they were supremely good, but unless they were good, they could not be corrupted. If they were supremely good, they would be incorruptible. If they were not good at all, there would be nothing in them to be corrupted. For corruption harms, but unless it could diminish goodness, it could not harm. Either, then, corruption does not harm, which cannot be, or, as is certain, all that is corrupted is thereby deprived of good. But if they are deprived of all good, they will cease to be. For if they are at all and cannot be at all corrupted, they will become better, because they will remain incorruptible. Now what can be more monstrous, than to maintain that by losing all good they have become better. If, then, they are deprived of all good, they will cease to exist. So long as they are, therefore, they are good. Therefore, whatsoever is good. Evil, then, the origin of which I had been seeking, has no substance at all, for if it were a substance, it would be good. For either it would be an incorruptible substance, and so a supreme good, or a corruptible substance, which could not be corrupted unless it were good. I understood, therefore, and it was made clear to me that thou madest all things good, nor is there any substance at all not made by thee. And because all that thou madest is not equal, each by itself is good, and the sum of all of them is very good, for our God made all things very good. Chapter 13. To thee there is no such thing as evil, and even in thy whole creation taken as a whole there is not, because there is nothing from beyond it that can burst in and destroy the order which thou hast appointed for it. But in the parts of creation some things, because they do not harmonize with others, are considered evil. Yet those same things harmonize with others that are good, and in themselves are good. And all these things which do not harmonize with each other still harmonize with the inferior part of creation which we call the earth, having its own cloudy and windy sky of like nature with itself. Far be it from me, then, to say, these things should not be. For if I could see nothing but these, I should indeed desire something better. But still I ought to praise thee, if only for these created things. For that thou art to be praised is shown from the fact that earth, dragons, and all deeps, fire and hail, snow and vapours, stormy winds fulfilling thy word, mountains and all hills, fruitful trees and all cedars, beasts and all cattle, creeping things and flying fowl, things of the earth and all people, princes and all judges of the earth, both young men and maidens, old men and children, praise thy name. But seeing also that in heaven all thy angels praise thee, O God, praise thee in the heights, and all thy hosts, sun and moon, all stars and light, the heavens of heavens, and the waters that are above the heavens, praise thy name. Seeing this, I say, I no longer desire a better world, because my thought ranged over all, and with a sounder judgment I reflected that the things above were better than those below, yet that all creation together was better than the higher things alone.